What is the National Security Agency, NSA, trying to do with surveillance all over the United States? What's happening under the Baltic Sea? Tell me more about the ground shaking and the booms that you hear in Clintonville, Wisconsin. And is it really over in Japan after that horrible Fukushima disaster? Up next, Linda Moulton Howe, our investigative reporter, earthfiles.com on Coast to Coast AM. Well, she really doesn't need much of an introduction, Linda Moulton Howe. She's been with us since the beginning of time, even though she's very young. Linda Moulton Howe with us with stories of high strangeness. Hey, Linda, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. It has been since the early 90s with Art Bell and then evolving through your tenure. And it isn't just high strangeness. It really, I'm focused on the science, the environment,
Oh, yes.
The issues that affect all of us. And I'm starting out tonight with what I think is truly one of the most important half hours I've ever presented, ever, on Coast. And it all starts with an author and an expert on the National Security Agency, who is James Bamford, born on September 15, 1946, in Natick, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And he was drafted into the U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War from 64 to 67, where he told me, quote, "I was a low-level paper shuffler in Navy intelligence, but not a formal analyst." And this is important because a lot of people say that he's an insider doing these books on the NSA. And he says that he never, ever was doing any formal naval intelligence, and that, in fact, it was doing his law studies at Suffolk University Law School in Boston, Massachusetts, on the GI Bill, that he became very interested in the National Security Agency and realized no one had written anything about them. And so he got a book contract, and his very first book, it was a revelation for me when I read it in 1982, The Puzzle Palace, a report on NSA, America's most secret agency. And now, at age 66, an author of two more books since then about the National Security Agency, Body of Secrets in 2002 and The Shadow Factory in 2008. James Bamford, on March 15th of this year, released in Wired.com another revelation about the NSA entitled, quote, "The NSA is building the country's biggest spy center. Watch what you say." Bamford wrote, quote, "For the first time since Watergate and the other scandals of the Nixon administration, the NSA has turned its surveillance apparatus on the United States and its citizens. It has established listening posts throughout the nation to collect and sift through billions of email messages and phone calls, whether they originate within the country or overseas," close quote. Well, his article set off an internet buzz and was discussed on March 20th during a House Armed Services Subcommittee on Emerging Threats and Capabilities that had before them NSA's Director General Keith Alexander. Adding more buzz to James Bamford's Wired.com article about his agency's gigantic expansion into a new Utah data center in Bluffdale, Utah, General Alexander told the subcommittee, quote, "The NSA is not authorized to do warrantless wiretapping, nor do we have the equipment in the United States to collect that kind of information," close quote. Well, the next day, on March 21st, James Bamford wrote another Wired.com article that countered General Alexander under the headline, quote, "NSA chief denies domestic spying, but whistleblowers say otherwise." And on March 25th, I talked with James Bamford at his London home about the insider source he had for the alarming details about the million-square-foot Utah data center now under construction and scheduled for operation in September 2013 that will have the ability to capture and store, quote, "all forms of communication, including the complete contents of private emails, cell phone calls, Google searches, as well as all sorts of personal data, such as parking receipts, travel inquiries, bookstore purchases, and other digital information," close quote. Here now from London, England, is James Bamford.
Among the people I interviewed for the article was William Binney, been the architect of the NSA's worldwide eavesdropping operation. He was really also in charge of automating the worldwide eavesdropping operations. He told me in very clear language how the NSA was intercepting the communications of Americans.
And in fact, you describe in your Wired article when he is talking to you and held his thumb and forefinger close together and said, quote, "We are that far from a turnkey totalitarian state," close quote. Could you talk about who he is, why he left the NSA, and how he came to tell you this?
William Benny worked at NSA for almost 40 years. He's a crypto mathematician making and breaking codes. And his job at NSA in the late 90s and during the 2000s, he was deputy chief of the organization at NSA that was responsible basically for eavesdropping all around the world. And he was the technical director. He was the one who helped create the system that made that possible. And he also was the founder and co-director of an organization known as the Signals Intelligence Automated Research Center, SART. That organization was responsible for taking the worldwide eavesdropping network and automating it so that information could be picked up automatically and sent back to NSA. But he left in disgust in late 2001 after discovering that the system he developed was now being used to eavesdrop on American citizens without a warrant, which is illegal. And so he did the honorable thing, which was not taking part of it and leaving the agency. And then he was quiet for many years about this, and then finally decided when I was doing this article for Wired to explain the system and how it worked.
So he is a person who certainly would have inside knowledge when he says we are close to a, quote, turnkey totalitarian state. How has this happened?
Well, it's happened because after 9/11, the Bush administration decided to weaken the laws and go around the laws and to begin turning NSA's giant ear that was always focused outward since the abuses of the Nixon administration and turn it inward. That was all done illegally and secretly by the Bush administration until December of 2005 when the New York Times made the revelation. And then after that, some of the reforms were put back into place, but they were in much weaker form than they were originally. Today, there's still no real accountability for NSA. They're not called before Congress and asked questions about how they do their work, how many people are targeted, how many Americans are there. So the American public is just left without any knowledge about this agency and how it does its work and whether the NSA is obeying the law. And if you look at NSA's history, and I wrote 3 books on NSA over the last 30 years, much of its history has been involved in illegal eavesdropping on American citizens. The NSA was formed in 1952 until 1975. During that entire period of time, NSA was illegally eavesdropping on American communications. They were reading every telegram that came into the United States or went out of the United States, went through the United States during that entire period in an operation called Operation Shamrock. Again, without any warrants, not a single warrant. They were also eavesdropping on telephone calls, anti-war protesters and so forth, again, without a warrant. And that was until 1975. And then there was this period from 1975, or actually 1978, when the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was created. Again, in 2001, the Bush administration turned NSA's eavesdropping on American citizens, and then the Congress changed the law to weaken the protections that were put in place in 1975. So for probably at least half its history, NSA was doing illegal spying on United States citizens. The American public has to wonder what this agency is, and it's never had more power than it has today because of the technological capabilities given to it.
And your March 15th Wired.com article provoked the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Emerging Threats and Capabilities. They held a congressional subcommittee hearing on March 20th. Before them was Keith Alexander, who is NSA's director. On the topic of eavesdropping on Americans, provoked by your March 15th Wired article, He told the subcommittee, this quote, "The NSA is not authorized to do warrantless wiretapping, nor do we have the equipment in the United States to collect that kind of information," close quote. Various media then picked up saying that he was denying everything that you had said in your Wired article. What is your response to what General Alexander is saying in his denials?
Obviously, the NSA has the capability to eavesdrop on Americans in the United States, because that's the whole idea that they were involved in the warrantless eavesdropping in the United States.
Has Mr. Binney provided you with hard evidence from his work there?
Well, he worked there for, like I said, 40 years, and he was in charge of the automation of that system. So the documents are all top secret. He's not going to bring out documents and hand me documents. I interviewed him in the article.
And isn't it true that the National Security Agency has its own definition of words that it refers to?
Yes. NSA has its own internal guidelines about how it does its eavesdropping. It's a very thick and very highly classified document. It's classified above top secret. And it's called USID 18. It stands for United States Signals Intelligence Directive 18. In that, it has its own definitions of what words mean, and one of the words that's defined is intercept, which is the key word that we're talking about here and that was talked about at the Congressional Committee. NSA defines intercept not the way the normal person would think of it, as capturing a communication as it goes through the air. With NSA, capturing a communication as it goes through the air or through a fiber optic cable or however it's being transmitted, that's not intercepting a communication. That doesn't really count. So they could be intercepting hundreds of thousands, millions, or billions of communications, yet technically they're not intercepting any communications. Capturing the information, storing it in Utah, is not technically intercepting the communications. It's only intercepted once that information has been processed and turned into a form that's understandable by a human being, in other words, into a report, a document. So you can have a great deal of communications in there, and you could have General Alexander say that none of that has been intercepted, but the phraseology of that term and the definition of that term and whether you're defining it the way Webster defines it or you're defining it the way USID 18 defines it.
Using words basically to manipulate and hide behind their own definitions, and it's as if you are describing an Alice in Wonderland world where up is down, down is up.
You also have to understand that William Binney is facing a long prison sentence for coming out and saying what he said. It's not just Bill Binney, there's numerous other whistleblowers that have come out. I interviewed a woman who was one of the intercept operators down in Georgia, where NSA does a great deal of its eavesdropping from. And her name was Adrienne Kinney, and she told how she was directed to eavesdrop on Americans, and she was required to record those conversations, transcribe them, and when she protested, saying that we shouldn't be doing this, she was told to go back and keep doing it, and she finally sent a letter to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and nobody did anything. She finally told me, because nobody else would take any action. Another intercept operator, David Falk, told me the same thing that confirmed everything she said. These are people that I would like to see, Bill Binney, Adrienne Kinney, and Falk, and so forth, put on a panel, sworn in under oath, and give their testimony. And I would like to see on another table the NSA answer some of these charges. That's never happened. And I think that's one way that the American public can start finding out what's really going on.
It is as if there is the National Security Agency, and then there is the rest of the United States.
NSA is unique in this country, the most unique agency I think that's ever been created in this country. NSA was created not by an act of Congress. It was created by a top-secret memorandum signed by President Truman in 1952. Even the contents of that memorandum more secret for decades until I wrote The Puzzle Palace and managed to get a copy of it. There are only a couple of people in Congress that were ever allowed to know that this agency was created in the first place. Even its name was top secret for much of the first decade. The joke had always been that NSA stands for no such agency or never say anything. So it's an agency that's existed and lived in total secrecy for its entire existence, and secrecy that's protected largely by law and secrecy that's very rarely breached.
If William Binney is right about the United States being so close to being a totalitarian state, where has Congress been throughout all this? How has this happened?
The problem is that Congress did fall flat on its face in terms of accountability for keeping the NSA accountable. That's the danger out there, and that's the danger that Bill Binney talked about. And when he talked about a turnkey totalitarian state, it doesn't mean that we're necessarily in a totalitarian state right now. It means that the infrastructure is there, and he was the one who helped build a lot of that infrastructure. It's ready to go. All it needs to be done is turning the key, and that's what he is worried about.
Do you think that William Binney is safe, or is there going to be retaliation against him?
I don't know. He certainly has a lot of courage because he's the first senior NSA official involved in such intimate work with NSA's eavesdropping activities. The very first to come out and speak as candidly as he has.
But he really is a patriot. If he doesn't speak out, then just like that lobster in that pot with the water coming up to a boil is what is happening in the United States.
Right, exactly. May give other people courage to come out and speak also.
So scary, Linda, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, it just keeps coming. On March 23rd, there was more news out of Washington under this headline. Quote, U.S. resurrects shuttered Bush administration total information awareness data mining program. U.S. relaxes limits on use of data in terror analysis. The Obama administration is moving to relax restrictions on how counterterrorism analysts may retrieve, store, and search information about Americans gathered by government agencies for purposes other than national security threats. Attorney General Eric Holder Jr. on Thursday, March 23rd, signed new guidelines for the National Counterterrorism Center, which was created in 2004 to foster intelligence sharing and serve as a terrorism threat clearinghouse. The guidelines will lengthen to 5 years from 180 days, that's 6 months to 5 years, they're changing this, the amount of time that this center can retain private information about Americans when there is no suspicion, underscore that, when there is no suspicion that they are tied to terrorism, intelligence officials said. The guidelines are expected to result in the center making more copies of entire databases and data mining them using complex algorithms to search for patterns that could indicate a threat. You combine this, George, Jeez. With the December 31st, 2011 NDAA signed by President Obama when he was on vacation in Hawaii, and what William Binney and other whistleblowers have told James Bamford, and stress that it is, to me, one of the most chilling quotes of my entire existence to hear that a man who worked for the NSA for 40 years, William Binney, a true patriot who was responsible for the architecture and engineering of so much that is inside the NSA's eavesdropping technology, that he would say, as James Bamford explained to me, he held his finger and his thumb about a half inch or an inch apart when he said to James Bamford for the Wired article, quote, we are that far from a turnkey totalitarian state.
More on this story. We're going to continue to follow this in the months to come. Up next, what's going on the bottom of the Baltic Sea? We'll find out. Very proud to announce, too, of course, Linda Moulton Howe with us. She's going to be in Nashville. That will be in May at Whitley Strieber's Dreamland event. You can get more information on that by going to unknowncountry.com, and I'm sure earthfiles.com as well. We'll be back with an incredible story about the Baltic Sea and what might be on the bottom of it. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda with us. Linda, so Whitley, he changed the date again, didn't he?
To May 18th.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. We're all going to be in Nashville, and a month before that, I'll be in Eureka Springs for the, I think it's the 24th annual Eureka Springs conference there. And I've made it every year except one. So,
good for you. Now, what is going on at the bottom of the Baltic Sea, Linda?
Well, you know, I have been so fascinated by the side scan sonar ever since last summer, when or fall, I guess it was, when they first started being circulated on the net by the Swedish diving company. And when you go to earthfiles.com, www.earthfiles.com, I hope everybody listening will do that so you can see these extraordinary side scan sonar images of not only the one that most people have seen that is sort of circular with a lot of lines in it, but there is a second fascinating object that's about 600 feet away, and I have a very good side scan sonar image of that. And also, what these people are that I'm going to be talking about and interviewing Peter Lundgren, who is one of the co-owners. And I think that when you go through the Earth Files report, you will begin to get an appreciation for why they have finally decided they want to go back in May, even though they've had a real struggle with money, because it costs $500,000 just to get a submersible down into this area that is 65 miles away from the nearest land. And I've learned some very interesting things about the Baltic Sea. I didn't know this before. It is a very good preservative because the salt content is there, but it's low, and there are no wood-burrowing organisms. And the head of the archaeology division at the Swedish Maritime Museum, his name is Andreas Olsen, estimates that there could be 20,000 shipwrecks on the Baltic Sea floor. And he compares it, he says, it's like a shipwreck laboratory, the best in the world, where the cold, dark water has preserved sunken objects for centuries. And what we don't know is what is the timeline on these very strange objects on the Baltic Sea bottom. It was a year ago, on June 10th of 2011, that 42-year-old Peter Lindbergh and his partner, Dennis Asberg, set off on an expedition that they were after three shipwrecks that they had researched and were convinced were on the bottom of the Baltic, and they hoped had good champagne and spirits and cognac in them like they have found before. And they had specific places that they were looking for, where they had researched that German U-boats had knocked down a Russian, or it was a ship that was a Swedish ship that was sent off to Russia. And this was during World War One. Well, after 9 days of technical difficulties, they had to change a boat. Their search was still ongoing, 60 miles from the nearest land, when Peter Lundgren noticed a very strange image on their side scan sonar. Now, the theories of what he's looking at over the last 12 months have ranged from ancient archaeological structures, 19th century Russian warships built in circular shapes, a Soviet Cold War underwater base, and even a UFO. But the old Russian round ships from the 19th century were only 30 meters across. And historically, none were ever supposed to be in the Baltic Sea. Now, the size of the large circular object goes to 60 meters, 197 feet. That's two-thirds of a football field, George. This is big object. And the sonar images of the unidentified object began to be compared to George Lucas's feature film star, the Millennium Falcon. So people started putting that out on the internet, and that even brought to Peter Lundberg and Dennis Asberg at the Explorer Ocean in Sweden even more questions about, can't you get down there on some kind of an expedition and find out what these are made of and what they might be? And so they're planning to return in mid-May 2012, not long from now. They're feverishly putting stuff together now, to go down with more sophisticated gear and see at least if they can determine without a dive. And you will learn now from Peter Lundberg, from the Swedish ocean explorer, why all of our essential intuitive sense that you just dive down to find out is not so easy. Here now is Peter Lundberg in Stockholm, Sweden.
Suddenly, when we were searching for one of the wrecks, this circle just showed up. Well, my first comment to the guys sitting around me was, hey guys, we have a UFO. That was, of course, for fun, but anyway, it looked like UFO. Then we checked the phone we had recorded, and we understood this is something very strange.
Can you talk about what's going through your mind and your discussions with your colleagues about what this might be?
The size of the circle is approximately 60 meters in diameter, and that the size of it when I saw it was the thing that I understood this is nothing that can be dumped from a ship or something. It's too big for that.
This is an object that is somewhat circular on the bottom of the Baltic Sea between Sweden and Finland that is 197 feet, and that is large. That is almost two-thirds the size of a football field down there.
Yeah, exactly. You can place a jumbo jet over it, and it will nearly fit inside the circle. Yeah, it's very big. Many things about this circle are strange.
Is it true that you found also a second object somewhere nearby?
Yes. We found a second object about 200 meters away from the circle.
When did you find the second object?
Just minutes later. Then we also have the track. It is about 4,000 or 5,000 feet long. The second object about 200 meters away from the circle, and it also has a track. A much shorter track, but it going in the same direction as the circle's track. And when we draw a line through the bases of the tracks, they cross at the same spot where the circle's tracks start or end. So it looks like they have come from the same direction, from the same spot.
When you say track, do you mean that it is like some sort of gouge on the bottom of the Baltic Sea where the big, almost 200-foot diameter object may have landed and that you're looking at the trail of where it scraped to the point where it is?
Yeah, it might be like that, absolutely. Or it could be some kind of remains from an old volcano or something. The sonar image, what I can understand from it, it doesn't look like that, but it can be that as well. We don't know really, but there are two tracks going to or from these two objects. The objects are not in the middle of the track. The tracks are either starting with the objects or ending at the objects. Both of the tracks are coming from the same spot, and from the circle it is about 1,600 meters away, and from the second object, it's about 1,800 meters away. But when we draw a line from the objects through the tracks, they end up at the same spot.
That spot is where?
1,500 meters south of the circle.
That was the impact site? And that the object slid to the position that it is in now, and the second object ended up in the position that it is because there was an impact and both objects slid on the bottom of the Baltic Sea?
If it is an asteroid, and when it hits the water, it's coming very, very high speed. And when it hit the water, this asteroid breaks up in two pieces. The smaller one flies away a bit, but the larger one, as we see now, the circle, is going through the water body with such high speed. It is a pressure wave going through the water down on the bottom, and the track is because of that. And then the circle ends up where it is now. The second object, the smaller one, when this object hits the water and this smaller object flies away a bit further on, and then it hits the water and sinks down. So I think in that case, the track is there because it has been a pressure wave through the water that has made the track.
Can you talk about both objects?
Yes, we have the first object, the circle, and it's round, but if you zoom in, you will see that there are some kind of objects are very squared. It's not natural formation on the bottom. The second object is about 200 meters away or 600 feet. It is about 120 feet across, but it's not round. It's like a rectangular box, but the top of it is like two arches put together. It looks like a church window, Gothic church window. And if they have been in one body from the beginning, we don't know, but I mean, it might have been like that.
The rectangular object with the arches may have been somehow connected to or inside of the larger round object?
Yeah, exactly. The circle is broken up in one side. I mean, it might be that the other object, the smaller rectangular shaped one, is a part that has been there in some way. And a lot of disturbances when we pass that.
Do I understand that as you were approaching the second object that's not round but has structure to it, that you had some kind of magnetic disturbance in your effort to photograph it?
Yes. I don't know if it's magnetic disturbances, but there is quite a lot of disturbances, and it is because of the waves. But when we pass the second object, lots of disturbances.
Peter, if these objects were made out of metal, would you know that from studying them with the side scan sonar?
No, we can't tell if they are of the metal or not. What we can say is that we have an echo on the other side of the side scan sonar, and that is because when the sonar waves or pulses hit this object, the sound waves or pulses are bouncing back very hard, so you get the echo on the other side. So it might be gravel or sand or rock, but we can't tell what it is.
Do you have a speculation about what they are made of and what they might be?
Well, I never seen something like this. The only thing I have to rely on is the sonar images. So I don't know more than anyone else. The second thing is that I am not a UFO believer, so I have very hard to believe this is something that is coming from outer space. It might be an asteroid, a comet, or natural thing, or I don't know.
But you said that your very first reaction was, this looks like a UFO.
Yeah, it did. But I don't believe in UFOs. Well, you know.
Can you talk more about why you think it's artificial?
Because when you look at the structures, the sides are not completely straight as they look now. But when we take disturbances away, there are completely straight lines. It looks like some kind of buildings or squared boxes. Then we have these thinner lines going through the circle. These are also straight when we take disturbances away. It's very, very strange.
Mm-hmm. Do they both appear to be intelligently constructed objects, not nature?
I have to put it like this. It is nothing as I have seen natural things before. It looks like, because of all these straight lines and very circular shape of the circle, I would say that, yeah, if it is natural, it's very, very strange. It would fit more if made by someone. I have difficulty to see that we have found something that is fallen down from space, which is not man-made, but made by someone else. So I'm trying to find natural explanations regarding this as well.
What are the next steps to get down there close and to do it with cameras and getting up close enough to do some testing where you might be able to figure out what these are made of and what they are.
Yeah, next step is we are preparing an expedition that will go out in mid-May, and we will bring quite sophisticated equipment with us so we can get three-dimensional images of the bottom. We will have something called sub-bottom profiler that will penetrate through the layer of clay down to bedrock so we can see if it is something natural, if it's something that has gone through the bedrock like a gas well or something like that. We will have more sophisticated sonars on them. We will have the cameras, and we will take bottom and water samples so it's nothing poisonous down there. Maybe we will dive on it if we think it's necessary. The thing is that it's very bad visibility in the Baltic. A diver can't see much more than 2 feet or something in front of him.
Why is that?
A lot of sediment in the water. We have to find out first if it is something poisonous. It might be leftover from the wars, maybe mustard gas or something more horrible down there. So it is very difficult and technical kind of diving, and it's very risky. The risk is visibility, the darkness, the coldness. Going down there, not knowing what he will find, might be leading to a diver's death, and we do not want that.
And George, you are hearing from a man who is 42 years old and has been diving since he was 16. So his experience in the Baltic is huge. And it was extraordinary to hear him talk about how dangerous it is to literally dive in some kind of a suit in the Baltic Sea. And about going down in the submarine. They've got a submarine that has 12 seats, but it costs $500,000 for them to get the submarine hoisted up. They have to have a ship big enough to have a crane, and it's a huge deal. And so they are interested in whether there are people who would like to participate, and if you divided $500,000 by 12 people, what that would be. But right now, they're up against a timeline that they feel in terms of weather and conditions that they need to get out there in mid-May, and this may not be the time that they could even try to do the submarine. And depending upon what their robots going down and the cameras see, he said they might make the decision that they might go that extra step and do a live man dive, knowing that they have to have some kind of light down there. But it is 275 feet down. So maybe this time in May, they will be able to report at least whether they are made of metal and seem to be something that is structured, whether it's terrestrial or something else, who knows?
This is a great story, and I can't wait to get some kind of preliminary results.
Well, he said I should call him again after they've been out there, so I'll do another update.
Absolutely, and let's probably do the update. If you get it in mid-May before your end of the month, of course, in May, you're going to be on a week earlier, aren't you, this time?
Yes, and it probably won't work for then. It'll probably have to be in the June.
Okay, but maybe a quick update from you.
I can get an update from them.
Okay, absolutely. Stay with us. Up next, you know, as we've been reporting on this incredible boom sound in Clintonville, Wisconsin, it just doesn't go away. Linda's gone a little more in-depth for us, and she's back with that story when we come back.